God's word in the book of Exodus and chapter 3. Exodus 3, we finished last Lord's Day morning at verse 10, so we read from verse 11, Exodus 3:11. But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" He said, "But I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain." Then Moses said to God, "If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'I am has sent me to you.'" God also said to Moses, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt. And I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. And they will listen to your voice, and you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, 'The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. And now please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God.' But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. After that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you shall not go empty. But each woman shall ask of her neighbor and any woman who lives in her house for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing. You shall put them on your sons and on your daughters. So you shall plunder the Egyptians." Amen. Well, before we turn to that passage to consider it, let's just quickly come before our God again. So we saw last week that there in the Horeb wilderness, God commissions Moses as his agent in rescuing the Israelites. We said the whole scene is more than just a commissioning, but it's certainly not less. It is a commissioning. And the opening verse of our passage this morning contains Moses' initial response to the task that God is giving him. Verse 11, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" Most people infer from those words some degree of reluctance on Moses' part. And that's possible because later on in this dialogue with the Almighty, reluctance is clearly present. But his "who am I" here may not be said in that kind of spirit. It's interesting that David uses exactly the same phrase in 2 Samuel 7, verse 18. God has just promised to him a dynasty, that indeed his throne will be established forever. And David responds in that verse, "Who am I that you have brought me thus far?" But David, of course, is not being reluctant. He's not saying, "Oh no, Lord, I'd rather you didn't establish my throne forever, if that's okay." No, he's expressing humility. "What, me? You're going to do this for me?" And Moses could be doing the same here. "What, me? You're going to rescue the Israelites through me?" But either way, it's God's ensuing remark in verse 12 that I really want us to note. That little phrase there, "I will be with you." That's what he says to Moses in verse 12. "I will be with you. I suspect those are not words that we're inclined to see as a very big deal. I mean, as Christians, we talk all the time, don't we, about God being with people. It's a cliche that rolls off our tongues. Lord, be with so and so, we often pray. But we should regard the concept of God's presence as a big deal. It wasn't just a cliche to Jacob at Bethel. Do you remember that solemn vow that he makes there in Genesis 28, verses 20 to 22? If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house, and of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. He desperately wanted God to be with him as he ventured eastwards, away from home. He was prepared to make some big commitments if only he might have this thing that we're talking about, the presence of God. It wasn't just a cliche to David when he wrote Psalm 139. You can sense his wonderment as he traces the extremities of this concept of God's presence with him. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me. It wasn't just a cliche to Christ's apostles as they set out to make disciples of all nations. That was a crazy commission that he had given them there in Matthew 28, 19 and 20. But Christ had rationalized it, you remember, on the basis that he would be with them. Behold, I am with you, he had promised. And that was enough for those men. And they went with the gospel to hostile, inhospitable places. And they were persecuted, and most of them laid down their lives. As long as Christ was with them, they were prepared to do such things. It wasn't just a cliche to the Apostle Paul, as he's in Corinth, and it's just this God-forsaken hellhole where the most unmentionable depravity is not only practiced but paraded and celebrated. And he feels he cannot go on there any longer. But then one night the Lord says to him in a vision, "Do not be afraid, for I am with you." And that kept him there. And we have a book to study in our Sunday evening sermons right now, because Paul was assured of God's presence that night and persisted with planting the Corinthian church. And you know, the promise of God's presence here in Exodus 3:12 wouldn't have been just a cliche to Moses. I mean, think of what's happening as he hears those words. Picture the scene. Picture Moses there, and he's barefooted because his sandals have been hastily discarded on this holy ground, and his face is shielded by his hands because he's afraid to look at God. In other words, here is a man powerfully aware in this moment of the awesome majesty of God, and that God, that overwhelmingly glorious God saying to him, "I will be with you," couldn't possibly be anything other than a big deal. And what the presence of God was then to these great Bible characters, I'm saying it should be to us. We need to lift this concept from its bland, cliched status. God being with us ought to be something that amazes us and thrills us and sustains us in our Christian lives. And from our passage then, there are three things I want to particularly notice about God's presence. First of all, a disguised presence. A disguised presence. And this is verse 12. You know what it's like when you watch one of those nature documentaries and the hour-long program is just this unrelenting wildlife bonanza. And you get the impression that wherever these film crews go, they strike gold. And there are snow leopards and mountain gorillas and sea otters just kind of waiting to be photographed. But of course, that's not the case. The reality is that to get that 5 minute footage of the snow leopards, the crew had to camp out in difficult conditions for 2 weeks, experiencing all kinds of setbacks and discouragements along the way. And it was the same when it came to the mountain gorillas and the sea otters. And when you and I think of the story of Moses, what comes to our minds perhaps resembles a little that nature program. Or at least the story of Moses from this point to the events at Mount Sinai. We think of it as just an unrelenting bonanza, as spectacular incident follows spectacular incident. And there's the burning bush here in this scene. And then, of course, there are the plagues. And then there's the Passover. And then there's the crossing of the Red Sea. What a thrilling sequence of events. And what a lucky fellow, therefore, Moses is. But just as that program doesn't reflect what the film crews really had to endure, so that potted narrative in our heads doesn't reflect what Moses really had to endure. For him, as for them, mixed in with the high points were many setbacks and discouragements along the way. And I think that's strongly hinted there in verse 12. God said, "I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain." Isn't that interesting? God is saying to Moses, it will only be when you get to Sinai. That, by the way, is what is meant by "you shall serve God on this mountain." Sinai and Horeb, where Moses is right now, are the same place. It will only be when you get to Sinai that you will have unambiguous, irrefutable evidence that this whole thing has been of God and you've been divinely sent. It will only be your arrival there which verifies incontestably that I have been with you, Moses. That will be the sign. That will be the testimony. That will be the proof. That's what God is saying here. In other words, it isn't the case that every moment of every day from the burning bush to Sinai will scream out, "God is present with Moses." No, many moments along the way won't scream that. Many moments along the way will scream the very opposite, that God is distant, that God is miles away. From the vantage point of Sinai, it will be retrospectively unmistakable that Moses has had God's presence. Prior to that, it won't be so clear-cut. Prior to reaching the mountain, there will be no definite sign which once for all ends all arguments. The evidence of God's presence will appear mixed and inconclusive. To some degree, God's nearness will be imperceptible, hence my heading, a disguised presence. And it's important that you and I get this. It's important that we don't have a romanticized view of God's presence, as though God's presence in a person's life turns that life into one long success story. If we have that view, then most of us will have to conclude most of the time that God isn't with us, because we're not experiencing unrelenting success. We're experiencing setbacks and discouragements by the bucketful. One of the nice things about the snow and ice these past few days is that it's been a welcome break from mud over the last few weeks. With all this rain we've had, going for a walk anywhere has usually involved traipsing through an awful lot of mud. And perhaps that's a good picture of your life right now. You feel like you're traipsing through mud each and every day. And as you slog along, you're not confronted constantly with compelling proofs of the power of the presence of God. Just more squelching and slipping and getting nowhere fast. That's your life. And I'm saying to you, that's normal. That's how it was for Moses. For him, the compelling proof of the presence of God would come retrospectively once he stood on Mount Sinai. And for us, the compelling proof of the presence of God will come retrospectively once we stand with all the redeemed on Mount Zion. Then there will be no doubt. Then we'll be able to trace God's unfailing presence as we look back over all the scenes of our lives. I'll bless the hand that guided. I'll bless the heart that planned when throned where glory dwelleth in Emmanuel's land. Up until then, however, we shouldn't be surprised and we shouldn't be disconcerted if God's presence with us is often disguised. And you might say, but Dan, if it's so disguised, then isn't it rather meaningless? Does it really make any difference? Mightn't God just as well not be present with us at all? To which my reply is, oh, it does make a difference, all right. God's presence is effective in our lives, and we'll come to that in our third point this morning. It isn't that God's presence is ineffective, that's not the issue, it's just that it's effective within a context of setbacks and discouragements which presently cloud our perception and obscure our view. That's the issue. So again, I say to you, if this morning God's presence with you is disguised by all the struggles and difficulties that you're facing, you don't need to ask despairingly where it all went wrong and why your Christian life is so deficient. You don't need to reevaluate whether or not you really are a child of God. There's nothing suspect about your Christian experience. It's perfectly normal. You're in the same boat as most other believers, past and present. And so I hope in a strange kind of way you can be encouraged by this first point this morning, as uninviting as my heading may sound at first, a disguised presence. But then let's move on and notice secondly, a defining presence. A defining presence. And this is verses 13 to 15. So in verse 13, this extraordinary dialogue continues. Then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? Again, there's no reason to think at this point that Moses is prevaricating, that he's trying to resist the commission that he's just received. What he says here is quite reasonable. The question that he envisages the Israelites asking, Moses, this God of our fathers that you're going on about, who the dickens is this? We don't know who you're talking about. Tell us, please, his name. That was a realistic question. I mean, for one thing, it fits, doesn't it, with what we've seen so far in these early stages of Exodus. We've seen that the Israelites aren't in a good way here. We said last week that even in their dire circumstances just now, they don't seem to be praying, crying out, yes, but not with any thought of God in their cries. There are exceptions, of course. Thankfully, there always are, even at the darkest moments in the history of God's people. There are the midwives and there are Moses' parents. But on the whole, God doesn't seem to be in the picture for the Israelites. And it's no massive surprise then if they don't actually know his name. And then for another thing, not only does this fit the portrait of Israel that we're given in this part of Exodus, it fits too with a literary feature in the latter stages of Genesis. And that literary feature is this. God's name, which of course is Yahweh, translated in our Bibles, the Lord, in block capital letters. That's the answer God gives to Moses' question here. In the latter stages of Genesis, God's name, Yahweh, is less commonly used than it is in the earlier stages of Genesis. Suggesting that even then, even among Jacob's sons, Joseph, of course, being an honorable exception, even then the rot was setting in. And intimacy with God, because of course it's an intimate thing to address God by his very name, intimacy with God was already on the wane several centuries before this point that we're now at in the story. So the idea then that God is going to need to remind his people of his name here. It's an altogether reasonable idea, I'm saying. But the fascinating thing in these verses is that God actually goes beyond giving a mere reminder. as he reminds his people of his name here, he also explains the name. And that's important not only for the Israelites here in Egypt, that's important for the person reading the Bible, because this explanation wasn't there back in Genesis. In Genesis, the Bible reader simply encounters this name Yahweh without any explanation. The characters using it may well have known its meaning, but that meaning was withheld from us readers, but not anymore. Here in Exodus 3:14, we are told it. Now, some of you may be feeling I'm over-egging this somewhat, because you may have read this passage many times over the years, and you may well feel that this explanation of God's name leaves you pretty much none the wiser. I mean, it just seems to raise more questions, does it not, than answers. And that's reflected in the various different interpretations of the explanation that you come across. It's often interpreted in very abstract, philosophical terms. I am what I am. It points to the idea then that God is not dependent on anyone or anything outside of himself. God just is. Indeed, this interpretation tends to connect God's name to the burning bush. The fire there is self-sustaining. It doesn't require any fuel. Hence, the bush isn't consumed. And God, similarly, is self-sustaining. And that's what his name, Yahweh, declares. That, as I say, is a common approach. But I'm always a bit suspicious of interpretations like that. I have a feeling that the Bible is much more into relational descriptions of God than abstract descriptions. Let me give you an example to show you what I mean. Deuteronomy 6, verse 4. I mean, that is one of the most famous texts in the Old Testament. You all will know it. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And gallons of ink have been spilt interpreting that verse as this abstract description of God. It's about how he's one in the sense of having an undivided essence and all that kind of stuff. Actually, if you just read the next verse there, I think it's pretty clear in what sense God is one. Verse 5 of Deuteronomy 6 continues, you, that's God addressing now the Israelites, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. Do you see the logic there? You, God's people, are to be one. That is to be single and undivided in your love for God, because God is one. God is single and undivided in his love for you. That's the logic. In other words, the statement God is one is not an abstract description of God about his undivided essence or something. It's a relational description. He's single-minded and wholehearted and all committed in his love for his people. And I think the same is true then when we come to this statement in Exodus 3, verse 14. My first suggestion regarding this statement is that we adopt the footnote reading, so I will be what I will be, rather than I am what I am. And having done that, I think we should connect it to two other statements in Exodus. First, chapter 33, verse 19. This is another famous one where God says, he's talking to Moses, I may call my goodness pass before you and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord Yahweh, and I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious and will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. So you can see immediately there, can't you, the I will be connection with our text here in Exodus 3. And what comes across there in that verse is this note of defiance. I will be merciful when I jolly well want to be merciful. And my mercy may often seem ridiculous, and there may be myriad logical reasons for me to withhold it, but no one and no thing is going to dictate how I channel my mercy. It's entirely my own decision. It's entirely up to me. If I want to be merciful, I defy anyone to try and stop me. That's the spirit of those words there in Exodus 33. And the same defiance then is present here. It's what's behind, I would suggest, the first "I will be" in this phrase, "I will be what I will be." You could read it with this emphasis: "I will be what I will be." Or you could even paraphrase it: "I jolly well will be what I will be." But what about the second "I will be" in the phrase? What does that mean? Well, this is where we should bring in another statement in Exodus, and for this one we don't have to go so far. Just back two verses, verse 12. "I will be with you. I will be with you." That's what God has just promised. And here now in verse 14, he's saying, "I will be that, all right. I will be what I've just said I will be. I will be the with you God. I'm defiant about that. My presence with my people may often seem a ridiculous concept, and there may be myriad logical reasons for me to withhold it, but no one and no thing is going to dictate where I channel my presence. I am the God who will be with my people, and make no mistake, I will be what I will be." Now, just a couple of loose ends to tie up here. First, I think this interpretation that I'm giving does actually connect with the burning bush. It isn't that the fire represents the God who needs no fuel to sustain him. The fire, we said last week, represents the persecution that Israel, represented by the bush, is experiencing at the hands of Pharaoh. But look again at verse 2 of our chapter. "And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush." God is in the midst of the bush. God is stubbornly present, in other words, with this people that don't even know his name. "I will be what I will be. I will be the with you God." It's a powerful picture, I'm saying, of that. And then secondly, you might be wondering what precisely the word Yahweh has to do with this phrase, "I will be what I will be" anyway. Well, Yahweh is simply that phrase in its third person form. So instead of "I will be what I will be," "he will be what he will be." That is Yahweh. But you see then the significance of all this. What it means is that God's presence with his people is enshrined within his very name. That's the point here. God's presence with his people is enshrined within his very name. We all know the importance of names, don't we, in biblical thinking? In the Bible, names aren't merely functional labels, a useful way of distinguishing this person from that person. No, names describe and define their owners. God's name then tells us who God is. And who is he then? He's Yahweh. He's the God defiantly committed to being with his people, come what may. That's what I mean by a defining presence. I mean God's presence with his people, to some extent, defines who he is. It isn't just some peripheral thing about him, like the brand of toothpaste that you happen to use to brush your teeth each morning. Your closest friends probably don't know which brand of toothpaste you use to brush your teeth. Not because it's a fiercely guarded secret or anything, but because it's peripheral. It isn't part of who you are. God's presence with his people is part of who he is. His name centers on it. What a gloriously extraordinary thing. Last week I mentioned that phrase in verse 8, God saying, "I have come down. I have come down." And I made a link then with what happens all those centuries later at Bethlehem. But you know, such links and not merely present in pithy little phrases like that one. Actually, every time you encounter the name Yahweh in the Old Testament, or in our English Bibles, the Lord in block capitals, there is a link to Bethlehem. Because if God is as defiantly committed to being with his people as this name declares that he is, the logical conclusion of that is him eventually going the whole hog and exchanging heaven for earth and getting as close to us as he can possibly get, even indeed taking our very human nature. Never does Yahweh have more meaning than in that straw-filled manger. There, more than ever, the name comes into its own. What a God this is. How uninventably sublime. A God who writes into his very name his commitment to being with his people. So a disguised presence, a defining presence. And then thirdly, this morning, a decisive presence, a decisive presence. And this is verses 16 to 22. It's the Six Nations just now. Some of you may have watched some of these rugby games that are going on. And when you watch a game then, there are spells where the team that has the ball just seems to be passing it from side to side of the pitch, not really making any progress up the pitch. But then they manage to get a maul going, a whole bunch of these absolutely enormous men just driving together toward the try line, the ball concealed somewhere in the middle of it all. And boy, once they get going then, nothing can stop them. The opposition defences are just blasted out of the way, everything in its path. You almost feel that if the maul didn't stop once it got over the try line, it would blast a hole in the very stadium itself. And it feels a little bit like that in these verses, verses 16 to 22. What God describes is going to happen over these coming days and weeks is basically several formidable obstacles just being blasted out of the way. Three in particular. Number one, Israelite blindness. Israelite blindness. That's verses 16 to 18. Verse 16, go and gather, this is God speaking to Moses, remember, go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt, and I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hivites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. And you think, well, what a waste of time that's going to be. Moses going to the elders of Israel and telling them all that. I mean, we've talked again this morning about what kind of shape Israel's in just now. We saw what happened the first time Moses tried to fulfill the role that God was giving him. We saw how the Israelites just rejected him. Who made you a prince and a judge over us? I mean, if Moses turns up now, they're just going to say, oh, this guy, he keeps turning up like a bad penny, doesn't he? Especially when he has this improbable tale that a God whose name they don't even know has met with him. I mean, this is just ridiculous. Surely Israel's blindness just makes this proposition here utterly hopeless. But remarkably, God continues in verse 18, and they will listen to your voice. And they will listen to your voice. And you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. And now please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. By the way, I don't think they're being slippery here. I better say that to preempt a long discussion on the ninth commandment again at the Zoom fellowship this evening. I don't think that they're being slippery here when they say, please let us go a 3 days' journey when we know they're planning to head all the way to Canaan. 3 days' journey is a bit of a phrase in the Old Testament. We encounter it at several points. And it means something in the ancient world. It means something like beyond the vicinity of somewhere. A 3 days' journey is taking you beyond the vicinity of somewhere. So in Genesis 30, verse 36, Laban and Jacob, the relationship between them is getting worse and worse, and Jacob wants to leave, and Laban knows that he wants to leave, and Laban's trying to make it as difficult for him to leave as possible, and he's struck this very ropey deal with Jacob, which looks as though it's going to keep Jacob impoverished and going to keep Jacob from ever being able to leave. And Laban then ensures that between Jacob and himself, there's 3 days' journey. And it's so that then Jacob cannot possibly come and steal any of Laban's sheep. And I can't go into all the details now. But the point is that Laban sets a 3 days' journey because he's really putting a significant distance between the two of them. He's making sure he's well beyond Jacob's vicinity. Or then Jonah, there are debates as to how the first few verses of Jonah chapter 3 are to be translated, but when Jonah is vomited out of the fish, it seems that he then has a 3 day journey to get to Nineveh. And I think the point there then is that it's still a very significant journey. Nineveh isn't right in front of him as he's been vomited out of the fish. In other words, there's still a lot of time and a lot of space for Jonah's new resolve to forsake him again. It's still a test of his obedience because he's got to go a long way still to get to Nineveh. So again, the point is that 3 days' journey takes you well beyond the vicinity of somewhere. And so when they say here that they're going to go on a 3 days' journey, Pharaoh isn't going to say, well, that's not all that far, just 3 days, they'll be back soon. He will understand perfectly well that they're saying, we're going well outside your domain now. We're leaving your domain. And he will understand the seriousness of this proposition. So I don't think that they are being slippery here. But as I say, the remarkable thing is really that the Israelite elders are going to comply with Moses. This man whom they rejected so emphatically those years earlier. They will now comply with him to the point of seeing him as their representative. They will say to Pharaoh, God has met with us. Well, God hasn't met with these elders of Israel. He's met with Moses. But they're happy to use the plural first person pronoun. He's met with us. And so here's obstacle number one, blasted out of the way. Israelite blindness. A second obstacle, royal power. Royal power, that's verses 19 and 20. But I know, God continues in verse 19, that the king of Egypt will not let you go. It has here, unless... I think it's better, not even. He will not let you go, not even if compelled by a mighty hand. And so the point is here that even if the Israelites were to march up to Pharaoh with the most enormous army, with all the most sophisticated weaponry, even then they would have absolutely no hope of getting out of his clutches. Because this is the most powerful man on the planet, and he's got plenty of resources to match any threat that might come against him. And so even if you have a mighty hand, and of course they don't, but even if they did, they wouldn't be able to wriggle free of Pharaoh. By the way, you might think, well, why wouldn't Pharaoh want to get rid of these Israelites? I mean, his predecessor spent the whole of chapter 1 trying to wipe out the Israelites. Wouldn't this be a welcome thing for him now to see the back of them? Probably the point is that he's now benefiting from this slavery campaign, which has failed to wipe out the Israelites as his predecessor had hoped, but he's now benefiting from that, and these cities are being built, and it's doing great things for the economy. He now doesn't want to get rid of these slaves. And also, of course, there's a danger that if they do march out of Egypt, they will just join with Egypt's enemies and turn on Egypt and fight against Egypt. So that's why I think Pharaoh isn't going to let them go. And so it seems, again, hopeless. Okay, we've got past the Israelite blindness. The Israelites are on board. Pharaoh's not going to be on board. He's not going to let this happen. And he's powerful. But then we move on to verse 20. I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. Talking about the plagues, of course. After that, he will let you go. He will let you go. And so there we have another obstacle. Just blasted out of the way. And the maul gathers more and more momentum. And then a third obstacle, Egyptian snobbery. Egyptian snobbery. We're not given many insights, are we, into how the normal population of Egypt takes all this anti-Israelite stuff. I mean, when they're commanded to throw Hebrew babies into the river, are they dismayed by that decree, or do they just shrug their shoulders and get on with it? We're not told. But whatever their response to that decree, I think there is a hint in our passage here that the ordinary Egyptians had at least bought into the royal view of the Hebrews as an inferior people who were fit only for slavery. Look at verse 22. Each woman, that's each Israelite woman, shall ask of her neighbour and any woman who lives in her house or lives in the same house, that means, for silver and gold jewellery and for clothing. Now, why on earth would Egyptians and Hebrews be living in the same house? Well, there can only be one reason. Because these Israelite women are the slaves of the Egyptians. And so the slavery in Egypt goes beyond just the official high-level slavery of the men being sent off to build cities. Just in the villages and towns of Egypt, there's all this slavery going on as Hebrew women are the domestic slaves of Egyptian families. Because they look down on the Israelites. They're our slaves. They're only fit for that. And so it's not just then Pharaoh and the slave masters who are going to resist the Israelites walking out of the country. All these normal Egyptian households are suddenly going to be bereft of their slaves. They're going to resist it too. And again, it just seems then like another barrier. Got to get past this Egyptian snobbery. Well, this one falls by the wayside too. Verse 21, I will give this people favour in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you shall not go empty. And in fact, the irony of that is, it turns out in the next verse, it's not simply that the Israelites will not leave empty, the Egyptians will be left empty. You shall plunder the Egyptians. The end of verse 22. Egyptian snobbery, like Israelite blindness and royal power, blasted out of the way. And how come then? How come these three formidable obstacles just fly away suddenly? Surely we're meant to see, in the light of this passage, God's presence is the answer. God's presence is the explanation. God's presence is decisive. And yes, the blasting of these obstacles out of the way won't at all points be in such an outwardly spectacular manner as to exclude all setbacks and discouragements. As we said, there will be plenty of those. It won't always look and feel on the ground as though these obstacles are being blasted out of the way, so that to a degree it will be a disguised presence. But behind the disguise, the presence will be decisive, all right. And God's presence always is. And it is for us. And we can apply this then in terms of the big picture. What a phrase that was that came up in our membership vows this morning. The promoting the evangelization of the world. What a crazily ambitious phrase. The evangelization of the world. How can the world possibly be evangelized? Think of all the obstacles, all the false religions, all the regimes pitted against the evangelization of the world. How can it possibly happen? Satan is the god of this age. How can it happen? They will be blasted out of the way because God is present with his church. And again, it won't be in such an outwardly spectacular manner at all points that there aren't many setbacks and discouragements, but God's presence will be decisive. And the world will be evangelized. And then again, we can apply it at the individual level. How are you going to reach the heavenly kingdom? You, little you, in all your weakness, all your susceptibleness to temptation, an enemy prowling, seeking to devour you, trials and temptations bombarding you every day. How are you going to make it through all the obstacles and get finally to the heavenly kingdom? Because God is present with you. And he will blast out of the way all those obstacles. Again, not in such an outwardly spectacular manner, as there won't be many setbacks and discouragements. But his presence will be decisive. And you will finally stand with your feet on the threshold of the heavenly kingdom. So keep going, Christian. Keep going. Because this is no cliche. This is deeply, deeply, transformingly meaningful. I will be with you. Amen.